Leadership in times of uncertainty can be challenging. In this episode, Gary Bowles talks about how to build an inclusive future of work. We discuss various topics from skill building to culture to leadership and the role next generation CHROs need to play. Hello and welcome to the Human Works podcast. And this is your host, Anish Lalchandani. The future of work is uniquely human. On this show, I take you on a journey to explore different perspectives to learn, grow, and thrive. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Gary Bowles to the Human Works podcast. He's the author of the latest book, The Next Rules of Work, the mindset, skill set, and tool set to lead your organization through uncertainty. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Please, can you share with our listeners a bit about yourself and the work? I know you wear multiple hats, so we'd love to hear what all do you do.
So I typically wear three hats, which I spin constantly. I'm the chair for the future of work with Singularity University, which is a global learning platform with a range of amazing catalysts trying to focus on helping to solve some of the greatest challenges in the world. I also have a small consulting company called Charette, where we dive into a range of different initiatives focused on the future of work, the future of learning, and the future of the organization. And then because there's not enough time in the day, I also have a small software company called eParachute, which is built from the work of What Color Is Your Parachute, which is the world's enduring career manual.
Wonderful. No, I think I've come across the work from Singularity University, and that's great. Some of the thinking and the futurists who come in and talk about it, that's amazing to kind of see how the technologies are evolving, but also how we need to evolve as humans to, you know, catch up and learn some of these things. So that's pretty interesting. I would like to dive into your book, and you talk about like few futures, you know, couple of futures in the book. Can you share with us a bit more about what those futures look like and what's your view on that?
So as I'm fond of saying, the future of work as a topic was theory in January of 2020, and by April, it was practice. So we went from a lot of the general headlines that you would see about the future of work, which often were about robots and software taking our jobs. So the framework that I offered in the book is, all right, so whether it's robots and software or not, let's think about the messages that we're getting about how much work there will be for humans. There's one future, which is there's going to be tons of work that is going to be developed by, it's going to be enabled by technology. We're going to have artificial intelligence software that's going to help us to be able to solve problems we never could have solved before. And there will always be tons of work for humans to do. There's another future that comes from many of those headlines, certainly came before the pandemic, which is that robots and software are going to eat a whole bunch of jobs. And so if you think of that as a Venn diagram with a bunch of people, humans, with skills to solve problems and a bunch of work demand, then the work demand circle gets smaller because robots and software chewed up a bunch of it. And that was certainly the rhetoric that we would hear a lot before the pandemic. And then the third future is where you get both. Well, how is that possible? How is it possible to have a whole bunch of work opportunity, but then a whole bunch of people not working? Well, that's exactly the situation here in the United States. We have a record number of job openings in the United States, and we have still a pretty high unemployment rate, but they're not matched up. That is, the humans don't want to do that work, or for a variety of reasons can't, or are unable to, and the employers are having a really hard time hiring. And so you have this mismatch, which was the third future that I talked about when I wrote the book.
Interesting. I think when you talk about the third future, you know, even in Singapore, I would say we do not have high levels of unemployment, but there are kind of jobs people don't want to do, which is where it comes in. Do we bring in technology? Do we bring in talent from outside? So those kind of questions come up as well. So it is interesting. And where do you see, you know, where would we land? What's your take on which version of this future we may go into?
So depending upon the economy, depending upon the society around the world, what seems to be pretty common is that you'll get these mismatches in markets over and over again. That is, you'll have a whole bunch of what are often called in-demand skills or 21st century skills and so on. And there's many countries that are not training for those skills. Although with Skills Future Singapore, there's no question that Singapore is actually one of the leaders in this attempt to try to solve that problem, make sure you're training for the skills that people are hiring for. And then there's a whole bunch of people that did work that was actually in demand years ago, but isn't in demand anymore. And they need to be able to develop those skills. And so you're going to see this kind of oscillation back and forth with lots of markets where there's going to continue to be skills that are people would hire for tomorrow if they could find the workers. And there's going to be workers who, for whatever reasons, either are unprepared, untrained, or unwilling to do certain kinds of work. And the kinds of work they're unwilling to do are, you know, as you were referring to, often, you know, menial jobs, repetitive jobs, you know, those sorts of things. Things we're probably going to automate anyway. It's just that we haven't done that yet. We don't really have that automation, nor do we have the training in many countries to actually get people doing the in-demand jobs. So you're going to see that oscillation probably over and over again going forward.
Yeah, that's interesting. And in your book, you talk about, you know, mindset, skill set and tool set to lead organizations through uncertainty. And we've been talking about skills just now. So can you unpack that for us in terms of how do you see these three together? What does it mean for people?
So the framing of the book is essentially how to lead through uncertainty, right? Because everything we're talking about nowadays is about how much uncertainty there is in the world. You know, it's not that we ever had a period of really strong certainty. We kind of knew exactly what tomorrow was going to look like. But you can certainly say the pandemic, which I call the Great Reset. As a matter of fact, I wrote an article on that topic in April of 2020. It's clear that the pandemic has shown us just how rapidly and how much at scale things can change. So working under the assumption that we're going to continue to have a lot of uncertainty in a lot of markets, in a lot of societies, in a lot of industries, if you could wave a magic wand, what are the things you would wish you could have to be prepared? So I use the example of mindset, skill set, and tool set. And the example that I often say is if I wave the magic wand and you and I were going to climb a mountain, and I'd given you all the skill set to climb a mountain, but you look up at the top of the mountain and you say, oh, that looks too high, I'm not going to climb today. It doesn't matter how much of the skill set you have. You don't have the mindset. So I wave the magic wand again, and now you have none of the skill set. You've never climbed a mountain before. But you look up at the top and you say, that doesn't look too high. And you take one step, two step, and eventually reach the top. And you look down and you say, how hard was that? So that's the difference between mindset and skill set. And as I often say, skill set's very important, but mindset eats skill set for lunch. If you have the mindset that you can solve a problem, you are far more likely to solve it. And if you don't have the mindset that you can solve it, you're probably right too. But if you're staring up at an ice wall as you're climbing a mountain, I don't care how good your mindset or your skill set is, you kind of want an ice pick and some really good shoes, and you need a tool set. And so that's why I point to the technologies and techniques that we need to be able to navigate uncertainty. And so this applies whether you're an individual worker in an organization, you're someone who leads a team in your organization, or you're someone who leads a larger part of the organization. It starts with mindset. It starts with having what I often refer to as a growth mindset based on Dr. Carol Dweck's book, Mindset. And it also means that you have to develop a specific skill set to be able to continually adapt to uncertainty. And then you also need to be supported by a tool set, next generation technologies and techniques.
I think that's interesting. And what you said is mindset eats skill set. So I think that's quite an interesting way to remember that, because you're right. I think it is a lot many times what our mind believes we can do. Yeah, and then we kind of, you know, start taking action or not taking action, which helps us to either learn a skill or not. And as we learn a skill, we possibly need a tool or a resource to, you know, bring those three things together to actually help us drive forward. So that's interesting way to put that, I would say. Yeah. And you also talk about skills. And so what would you say are the skills of tomorrow for teams, for organizations, for you know, employees?
So first off, we're in an amazing inflection point where I think we're on the cusp of cracking the code on human skills in the same way that we have cracked the code on the human genome. As a matter of fact, my company has an initiative called the Skills Genome Project, bringing together a range of innovators around the world, including Skills Future, to be able to talk about how these skills models can help us to understand our human skills better. So essentially, one of the simplest ways to think about this is that you actually have three different kinds of skills. You've got skills that are sort of anchored in a body of knowledge. Your knowledge of brain surgery isn't going to help you to repair a car engine or vice versa. So those are what are called no skills, bodies of knowledge. There are skills that are usable in a range of situations. If you were good at convincing your parents to let you stay up late when you were young, you're probably very good at persuading. And you're going to be a good salesperson. You're going to be a good business development person. You're going to be a good politician. Well, maybe you're not going to be a good politician, but there aren't very many of those. But you're going to have these transferable skills, which I call flex skills, that are usable in a range of situations. And then finally, you have skills that actually are about you, that when you show up on time, when you finish a project, when you manage your anger, those are self skills. So these no skills, these flex skills, and these self skills, it's critical to understand that they actually are useful in a range of different situations, depending upon how well you've developed those skills and what they're anchored in. No skills don't move around that easily, but the other ones do. So if I could wave a magic wand and help every person on the planet to have four flex skills, skills usable in any situation, I would say we should all be problem solvers who are adaptive, creative, and with empathy. And that just happens to spell out PACE in English, which is convenient because I talk a lot about the pace of change. Problem solvers, because that's why people hire us, and that's why we hire other people, to solve problems. My father wrote a book called What Color Is Your Parachute 50 years ago. And one of his premises was, if you present yourself to an employer as a problem solver, you are far more likely to get that job than someone who does not. So the more you approach problems and you make work problem-centric, the more you'll have the capacity to be able to solve the problems of today and tomorrow. Adaptive, because there's nothing certain in life but exponential change. We've all experienced that in the pandemic. We never would have believed that we could have shifted to this remote work and remote learning thing overnight in so many different places around the world. Creative, because that's what keeps us ahead of the robots and software. And with empathy, because that's another uniquely human characteristic that allows us to empathize with the needs of our coworkers, with the needs of our customers, if you're running a startup, with the needs of the market. And those together will help us to be able to continually solve the problems of today and tomorrow.
I think that's great. And the kind of, you know, framing of PACE is pretty interesting. And you're right, I think the pace of change, it has accelerated. There are a number of things, either because of pandemic or because of new technologies, things are changing so fast and so rapid. And I think that's another question which comes from the pace of change is there's so much of discussion going on around the future of work. But when I hear most of the discussion is around the future of workplace, you know, is it hybrid working? Is it, you know, where would we work from? And there are different tensions around that as well. But what I want to ask you is, how do you see really the future of work? What will the work look like in the future, which is the core? And then I guess the worker workplace aspects are, you know, around it. But what's your view on what will the future look like in terms of work?
So I appreciate the question. I honestly, even with though I have a title called the Chair for the Future of Work with Singularity University, I actually don't think of myself as a futurist. I think of instead possibilities. So maybe I'm a possibilist, but I think in terms of scenarios. But I'll tell you some of the underpinnings of one of the most consistent scenarios and really the way I would hope we want to design the work of the future. That is, there's a lot of different scenarios in terms of just how much work will be available as we were discussing. But if we were all to have control over building a more human-centric future of work, here's some of the things that you would want. The first is that you would want more work to be problem-centric and project-centric. If you think of it, work is really just three things. It's our human skills applied to tasks to solve problems. That's it. That's really what work is. And sometimes the problems are very clearly defined and the work is very repetitive. The tasks that we do are very repetitive. So the skills are not always required to be so very high level. And in other cases, the problems are completely undefined and they're wicked problems, deeply complex problems to solve. And so the skills that we need are much higher order. You know, we need much more creativity and problem-solving skills, and we need to be able to continually analyze and break down challenges, and we need to collaborate with others, and so on. So more problem-centric, more project-centric work. Work that actually is more human-centric in that humans get to decide what is the right context in which to perform work in any circumstance. So in the book, I talk a lot about the six W's of work, you know, what, where, when, why, how, and with whom we work, right? And so each of those six W's, which happen to be the questions Aristotle asked to determine if an act was moral, each of those different six W's affect the work of the future. So the what is the specific activities, the problems that you're solving. And ideally, you would be solving more challenging problems. You wouldn't just be focusing on those repetitive ones because we'll probably automate those. You'd focus on unique challenges and solving more complicated ones, especially with other people. Where, as you're saying, the workplace, you should actually be able to determine with your team or anybody else that you're collaborating with where you need to do your work on any given day or week. And in some cases, that's going to be in a traditional workplace. In a lot of cases, it might not be. But it's the choice to be able to do that. And you can just map it for the other ones, the how, the where, the why. Well, the why is actually really important because we talk about more purpose-driven work. We want to make sure that we're actually feeling that there is some reason that we are solving certain problems. And we want to feel that that actually resonates with us as human beings. So that's one of the reasons that you see a lot of this talk about the Great Resignation, or, you know, the ways that people are actually stepping back and saying, well, why am I working? Well, maybe I don't want to do that kind of work anymore. I want to do this kind of work. And so that's actually our opportunity, is to think about how we provide more of that flexibility to allow the work of the future to be continually determined in collaboration between human beings, as opposed to just defaulting to what I call the old rules of work, going back to corporate hierarchies, going back to traditional workplaces, going back to much more structured work, and instead building the organization of the future that can allow all of that to be far more flexible and adaptable.
Wonderful. I think, you know, you talk about, you know, the challenging and complex jobs, your work, a workplace where you have choices, and meaningful work or purposeful work, or where people have flexibility. I think that's, in a way, is a way it can bring in a different kind of calling for people to, you know, be interested in work, what they're doing. So that's great. In your book, you also talk about, you know, robots and softwares don't take jobs. It's humans do. I was like puzzled. What do you mean by that? I'm curious to know, what does that mean?
So let's go back to our basic premise, which is that work, you know, jobs have the six W's associated, but work is just human skills applied to tasks to solve problems. Well, what we often do when we automate is we automate tasks. Here in Silicon Valley, we find that the messages that the venture investors are giving to people doing startups is find something that people are paying for already, which is often messy, expensive humans. Automate that, and then a customer will pay for the automation and not for the human. So that's pretty much the message that Silicon Valley has sent for quite some time, is let's displace humans by, well, we can, we'll say that what we're doing is we're making them more effective, or we'll say we're freeing up their time. But what we're really doing is we're displacing human work, and we hope the system will function so that they'll get new work, right? Well, that's the way that it happens, is robots and software just automate tasks. It's a human's decision if those tasks add up to a job that goes away. In the United States, when we hit the Great Reset, we went into the shutdown for the pandemic, the U.S. went from about 3.7% unemployment to 18.1% unemployment in 3 weeks. Germany went from 5.1% to 5.7% unemployment. Because they actually have put frictions on the decisions that people make about whether jobs go away. Now, that can have some negative consequences in that it can be hard to fire some people. And it can have positive consequences in that when a virus comes along, it's actually a much more resilient economy. And so that's why robots and software don't take jobs. It's all about automation and automating tasks. And because we have taken this industrial era model of very rigid jobs and job structures and tasks associated with jobs, that actually we get this binary mindset that a human can just be disposable. And we have to make different decisions. We can make different decisions. and make much more human-centric work so that humans always are able to solve the new problems that need to be solved, can get paid well to do them. And then when robots and software automate tasks, it does nothing but enable humans to do better work.
Wonderful. But then in that context, do you see like a tension, like corporates would always like to, you know, reduce costs, automate majority of the work. And on the other side, possibly it would be governments and national agencies who would love to kind of, you know, really provide for employment and make sure unemployment remains low. So how do you see that kind of, you know, interesting balance between corporates who would definitely be far more commercial, I would say, in the nature, and governments who are definitely trying to do all the stuff for good?
So first off, I would challenge the assumption that the decisions made by those who lead in corporations always have to be about efficiency, mm-hmm. and you know, which would be a scarcity mindset, and instead be thinking about new capacity, which is an abundance mindset. So one of the ways to picture this as someone who leads in an organization is picture the people in your organization as icebergs, and that the part above the waterline is what you know about their skills and the problems that they can solve. But there is a tremendous amount of human potential and capacity below the waterline you know nothing about. Think about the first time you got on a Zoom call with your coworkers and you said, wait a minute, I didn't know you have a sick aunt at home. I didn't know you have kids. There's a guitar on the wall. You play guitar. We were just doing a focus group on our next product where we needed to bring in a whole bunch of musicians, and we would have brought you in if we'd known that. But the problem is you don't know what's below the waterline. And so there's all this tremendous human potential that you have, untapped human potential that you're not even aware of. And so you're going to dispose of that human because you're trying to cut costs and you're trying to increase productivity, as opposed to thinking about how you can continually help those humans to each have a North Star or a Southern Cross where they are directed in their own careers. They're continually learning new skills. They've got a growth mindset. They're continually able to solve new problems for the organization. And that shifts things into the plus side of the ledger, where you don't have to have this zero-sum mentality. Now, if you are an organization that is deeply driven by shareholders and everything is about quarterly results, it's kind of inevitable you're going to do this. So that's why I push very hard in the book to think about expanding the range of the organization's stakeholders so that shareholders get what they want. They get a growing company that's continually developing new value for its customers, but you are meeting the needs of your other stakeholders as well. Your workers, your customers, your suppliers, your partners, the communities in which you operate, and the planet itself.
Yeah, no, I think I love that challenge because that is the dilemma number of corporates are in, who live like quarter to quarter looking at top line, bottom line, all of that stuff. But what you bring in a point is a very interesting one, is around how much of that is short-term focus and how much is the long-term focus we want to bring in. And when we talk about stakeholders, employees are stakeholders as well. So what are we doing to build their skills so that they contribute back to the organization plus the economy overall? So that's great. And in your book, I guess it's an interesting segue. In your book, you talk about organizations and values and culture. When you look at the next rules of work, how do you see that changing besides what we've already talked about?
So these are complicated issues because humans are complicated. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world where the frictions to access to information, these digital distraction machines that we all carry around with us that we often call cell phones, we have this unlimited amount of information that seems to just keep on, you know, in an avalanche toward us. And what ends up happening is we have, I think it's increasingly more challenging to step back and think about values, individual values and organizational values. But because those are often kind of third rail issues for a lot of people, we use the same words for different things and different words for the same things when we talk about values. It's sometimes very difficult to get people, you know, to align and to talk about authentic values and exhibiting those authentic values. I focus a lot on behavior. Values are critical, but really what you want is to espouse, if you're somebody who leads in an organization, and by the way, you'll notice I haven't used the word leader at all. I use the word those who lead in organizations because I think we've kind of lost the meaning of the word leader. So mm-hmm. I use it as a verb. If you lead in an organization, what are the behaviors that you want, the common behaviors that you are urging others to actually follow in the organization. So that starts with mindset. That starts with the ways that you present yourself, the ways that you are trying to encourage behaviors in others, and the behaviors that you exhibit. So if on the micro kitchen wall, you've got a set of values of the organization that include, you know, the golden rule and always doing well by others and being collaborative, and yet you, as someone who leads in the organization, are continually cutting people off and dismissing them, and, you know, then you actually have a misalignment of the values in the organization by your behavior. So often what I suggest to those who lead in organizations is, first off, think of the process of determining what you want the mindset, the culture, the consistent values of the organization to be. Co-create that with your stakeholders and start with your workers at the beginning, because this can't be something where the leadership team goes off into a weekend retreat and brings back the answers about the organization's values like tablets from the mount. This has to be a constantly living and changing articulation of what the strategy of the organization is and the kinds of behaviors that the organization encourages to be able to deliver value to its stakeholders. And it's perfectly okay if you've got an organizational culture, if the mindset, the aggregate mindset, is around productivity and, you know, constantly pushing people to do their absolute most. And all of that's okay so long as everybody signs up. It's when you get asymmetries, when you get mismatches, when you're not aligned, as I often say, in the values of the organization, the behaviors that you're trying to encourage, that's where you get organizational dissonance. Now, this might have not been that big an issue for some organizations pre-pandemic, but when you suddenly shift to distributed work, you now have a completely different problem domain when you're talking about culture. So I often suggest to organizational, those who lead in organizations, several things. The first is, you probably don't know what culture you have, so you need inventory. Yeah. Survey relentlessly. Always ask people, what kind of culture do you think we have? Then focus on the behaviors, and especially the behaviors of those who lead in the organization, and do the kinds of training and the kinds of continual conversations and commitments that get people to agree the kinds of behaviors you need to see. Because if you, those who lead in the organization, don't exhibit them, everybody else in the organization is given permission to not follow them. And then finally, figure out how you will continually have a finger on the pulse on an ongoing basis. Because what ends up happening is, an organization of any size actually has no single culture. You have lots of microcultures, depending upon geographically where people are, depending on their backgrounds, their upbringings, and so on. It is a constant process of helping to align people within the organization around the key behaviors that you believe are necessary for the organization to be successful.
Well, that's so true. And I think your point around, you know, bringing people to co-create is the key one. That's where I think the resonance comes in. I was in a webinar with the CHRO for Lego, and they did something very similar a couple of years ago. They brought in a, you know, diverse group of people who lead this piece of work and bring in all employees along. And his journey and story, what he was talking about in the last 2 years, has been amazing. Compared to, he was saying, you could have easily brought in a consultant, did some work at the top team, and boom, but we wouldn't have seen these results in the next what they have. Yeah.
Well, Lego has a magnificent culture. You know, we collaborated with them on a project that we did with Google years ago, and tremendously creative. I mean, they are a pace organization from the beginning. But you actually, I think, hit two different aspects that are critical for people to call out. And actually, this came from a project that Google did. Google did a research project called Project Aristotle. It has nothing to do with, you know, my work that I call the Aristotle Canvas. Yeah. And Project Aristotle found out that there are only two things that were the underpinnings of the most effective teams in the organization: psychological diversity and psychological safety. So what you just described with Lego did both. You look around and say, wait a minute, we just can't have all the same people who look like me all trying to come up with solutions, because they're all going to be the same solutions. You walk into a meeting and they all look like you. You should stop the meeting and say, where's the creative problem solver? Where's the wacky dreamer? Yeah. Where's the person who's really, really solid and continually asks how we're going to get stuff done? Let's bring all of those people into this problem-solving process. But you have to create psychological safety. It has to be where you allow them to come up with the wacky ideas at the front end, because that's what's going to get you some of the out-of-the-box solutions.
And that's how you distinguish yourself as a brand, as an organization, and in the market as well. And I think it's an interesting segue into talking about HR. And I think, you know, in your book, somewhere at the end, you talk about a bit of HR. So what advice would you give to CHROs and HR leaders, you know, who are really ambitious, but they are like really thinking of how do we really lead in this future of work, in the next rules of work, and how do we, what do we do? So what advice would you have for them?
So first off, I want to make sure that I'm giving a shout out to the people who are in those roles, because this is one of the most challenging times. You've been asked to try to solve problems. You might have thought it was challenging before, and then along comes a virus. And what ends up happening is we just keep adding more and more onto the plate of the HR organization. And unfortunately, what we've done is we haven't given them the tool set that is often needed to be able to do that. So the first is, I think it's really critical to step back and to look at what HR itself needs to do to be the change that it wants to help navigate. It's really, really critical that those who lead in HR organizations have a growth mindset. Absolutely critical. You know, if you yourself are not committed to a learning path, if you yourself are not continually encouraging those around you to be collaborating on their learning processes, then how do you expect the rest of the organization to follow that lead? So you must be as much as possible the change that you want to see. Second is, and I know this might sound a little negative, but I'm giving you the tough love thing. It's really critical that HR is solving the problem, not creating the problem. Mm-hmm. There are actually two different faces of HR, two different facets of the organization. One of them focuses on basic blocking and tackling and process orientation and a set of tasks. Remember, human skills applied to tasks to solve problems, where HR can focus, especially traditional HR, on just the tasks. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't hire that person. You didn't go back and sign form 473 in triplicate. Well, this is ridiculous, because how are you going to be the change you want to see if you keep on defaulting back to these leaden processes that got you there in the first place? I was brought on as a consultant for a nonprofit, for an NGO, that took 1 year to bring me on as a consultant.
Yeah.
The problem I was brought in to solve didn't even exist anymore. It was a new problem. So I said, well, wait a minute. Here, let's do this. Let's do a workshop, a design thinking workshop.
Yeah.
And we'll bring in all the people that are associated with the process of bringing on consultants. And let's talk about, is this what we wanted? Did we want it to be a year? Oh, no, nobody wants it to be a year. Well, how was it a year? And we broke down that process and realized there's all of these ways that you can focus on the problem to be solved. We need consultants to come in really quickly and help us. And then you work your way backwards from that. You throw away a whole bunch of the tasks, the processes that you had fallen in love with before. So that's one aspect of HR. But the other aspect is the strategic aspect of HR. Back in the, I'm going to really date myself here. Back in the 1990s, I was the editorial director for half a dozen technology publications. And I would sit down with CIOs, heads of IT organizations, and they would just complain and complain. Why don't I have a seat at the table? Why doesn't the CEO call on me to help solve business problems? Well, the answer was they were focused on this blocking and tackling stuff, 99.9% uptime and all that kind of thing, managing all these different systems, and they couldn't focus on the strategic advantages of technology. It's the same thing for HR. So how did IT solve that? Several things. The first is you jettison as much as possible of those operational distractions. We now have this thing called cloud computing. That's where IT shoved a lot of those operational things so that it could focus on more strategic activities. So our HR needs to do the same thing. The second is that IT started to hire from outside of engineering and technology, people with different backgrounds to come into the IT organization. And that's what HR needs to do. If you grew up inside the HR organization, awesome. However, you need to cross-fertilize. You need to bring more people in from other backgrounds with other training into the HR organization, because they're going to help you with that psychological diversity thing. And then the third thing is embedding. Is IT started to embed more and more people, took agile practices and brought them out into the departments and divisions they were working with. And HR must do the same thing. It must be part of the process of solving problems where talented individuals have those problems. And that, those are all doable. Those problems are all fixable, but HR needs to do them yesterday because it's the only way that it's going to continually be that organization that can embody the change it wants others to follow.
Totally agree. And I think, you know, you're right. I think the point around having a seat at the table, that's moot now. I think it's about having the seat at the right table and doing the right things. Yeah. And I think you talk about, you know, growth mindset, strategic, solution oriented, if I put it that way, bringing diversity and embedding that, that's going to change, you know, the next normal, I would say, you know, all the new ways of working and the next rules of work as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so.
And we're almost coming to an end. I think the last question, Gary, I had for you was, how can we create an inclusive future of work?
So the final chapter in the book, I sort of take a 90-degree turn. And rather than just repeating everything that had been in the book already, I said, okay, so now what is the world we all want? Mm-hmm. And I talk about four different domains: individuals, organizations, communities, and countries. And the reason I do that is I try to help sort of expand the aperture and help people to think about, how can I have an effect? How can I have an impact in building that future that we all want? Well, for each of those domains, there is a problem statement. When you talk to individuals about their work, you find out they pretty much everybody wants to be able to find or create meaningful, well-paid work today and tomorrow. When you talk to people who lead organizations, they'll often say, my biggest problem is I need talented workers who can solve problems for my stakeholders today and tomorrow. If you talk to people in the communities in which your organization operates, and if it's a large organization, it operates in a lot of communities. They want to be ecosystems in which everybody can thrive. And then finally, when I advise ministers of labor and education in countries around the world, they want to know how they can have inclusive economies. All right, so that's the world I think we all want. We want all four of those domains, all four of those stakeholders to get what they want. And so how do we build that? Well, we have to change a lot of things because we have these industrial era processes that we have inherited that put friction on all of that. We've got this amazing mismatch in workforces. We've got this tremendous need for training for the future. And the only way we're going to solve all of those problems simultaneously is if we change the context. If we stop thinking about just bungee cording back to the old rules of work, and instead we start thinking about what would human-centric work look like. Well, it would look like stopping thinking about the organization as kind of being a box and having hard walls, and instead thinking about how to make it as what I call involving as possible. How do you do mentorships, apprenticeships? How do you open up the training resources of your company so that others outside the company can actually be trained in the kind of work that you hire for? How do you change your hiring practices so that you know more of this extremely high friction process of taking weeks or months to bring talented people in to solve problems of the organization, but you could actually break up the work, more problem and project centric work, so that you could actually try out people and they can try you out that you might eventually be able to offer more full-time work to. You have to cross-train. You've got to stop thinking of talent as being an owned resource by a manager. You notice I haven't ever used the word manager once. I call them team guides because I think we have to change the whole calculus where they're simply enabling people to be able to do their best work. And if you think of talent as an enterprise resource, that is anybody within the organization, if we did this right, could be solving a range of different problems in other parts of the organization. It opens up your mind how you can take advantage of what's under the waterline of the iceberg for each one of your workers. And then finally, in your communities, how can you authentically be involving populations you might never have involved before? How can you be hiring long-term unemployed, older workers, people who are on the autism spectrum, people with other physical challenges or limitations, young people? How can you open up the aperture, soften the walls of the organization so that you will actually be able to take advantage of all these amazing talents of all these human beings in ways you simply could not before? That's how I think we build a more inclusive future of work, is we think of ways to be able to soften the walls of the organization, help people to each have their own learning paths, continually bring in populations we might never have brought in before. And that's how we'll get that tremendously diverse set of thinkers if we build the kind of safe environment for them to be able to do their best work.
Lovely. I think I love the way you sketch the inclusive future where, you know, there's so much of abundance, but there's also so much around inclusivity around individuals, organizations, countries, and communities, you know, and there's abundance of talent, as you rightly said. It's a matter of how do we tap that? How do we go boundaryless in some ways to really, you know, use the talent and solve bigger problems in the world? Wonderful. I think, Gary, it's been lovely speaking to you. I think I really enjoyed it. How can listeners reach out to you?
So I've got a website, gbolles.com, G-B-O-L-L-E-S.com, where I post. I've got links to articles, to videos and so on. I've also got a link for the book, and I've got supplementary materials for the book as well. So look forward to anybody that wants to pick up the book and then wants to ask questions or see, you know, have additional help in thinking about some of the next steps. I've got a range of different resources on LinkedIn. I've got 9 courses on LinkedIn Learning. I just passed 1 million learners in total. So 1 or 2 people have taken the courses, and it's things like a learning mindset and learning agility. And then I've got, you know, a range of people communicating with me on LinkedIn. That's my preferred platform to be able to interact with folks.
Wonderful. I think what we will do is we will add all these details to the show notes so that people can reach out to you through LinkedIn, through your website. And I think I'll highly recommend Gary's latest book, The Next Rules of Work. Thank you, Gary.
All right. Thanks. That was great. Really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the show. See you next time.